I thought that it was a good thing to have a hot meal like that last night, because it was a good introduction to the informer. And also, lots of times you forget how really sensual a poem can be. How many have you, I won't ask you how far you've read in it, but how many of you have actually started reading the Inferno itself? If you have, you know that Dante's imagery is sensual to the extreme. I mean, there aren't any really any feelings that he misses out on. And when you get to the end where the people who are really so badly perverted and so so terribly distorted that the body itself is distorted, and this is very much a part of the way in which Dante understands the whole creation, the people are their heads are facing backwards, and he talks about in a marvelous image how they weep and the tears go down the cleft of their buttocks, which is so completely screwed around that's how completely backwards they are, and how frightening it is. And yet you think, how could you say it with more accuracy and more poignancy than that? And that's, you just have a building up of that type of imagery all the way through. But it is important that you not read it just to get through it. There's no point in getting through it, because you know how it's going to end anyway. It's not the plot of the thing isn't going to get you there, and you don't need to get there in a hurry. But the point is to let yourself in on the text itself so it happens to you. Because otherwise, it's going to be just an exercise in something that you have to do for a course. And none of you, I don't think, is here with that in mind. I'm going to read one more statement to you today before we begin on the Inferno itself, because it seems to me that it puts very clearly the basic reason for writing this kind of thing, why it's important to write things like the Inferno, and why it's important to read things like Charles Williams's novels, or Lewis, or Saul Bellow, or whoever you happen to be running into, because there is something that is a problem in all of the body of truth. And this was something that Coleridge said, and I remember I read it a long time ago, and I was reading a lot of things on the imagination and on fantasy and the fantastic. And I wrote it down, and it keeps on coming back into my mind. I thought, you should hear it, and I'll put it up on the wall sometime so that you don't have to write it down in a hurry, but you can just listen to it. Truths of all others, the most awful and mysterious, yet being at the same time of universal interest, are too often considered as so true, and these he underlined, he italicized, so true, that they lose all their life and efficiency of truth, and lie bedridden in the dormitory of the soul, side by side with the most despised and exploded errors. I'll read it again and then just talk about it for just a minute, and then you can chew it over yourselves. Truths of all others, the most awful and mysterious. And think about what truths you think are the most awful and mysterious in life for you. Truths of all others, the most awful and mysterious, yet being at the same time of universal interest. So they're not just private truths, they're universals. Are too often considered as so true that they lose all their life and efficiency of truth and lie bedridden in the dormitory of the soul, side by side with the most despised and exploded errors. I think you should think about what is meant by the efficiency of truth. The efficiency of truth, in terms of the way Coleridge puts this. How do you lose the efficiency of truth in any idea or thought or concept? And Coleridge tries to explain it in his usual very clear way by saying that it's sort of a parallel with that old adage of familiarity breeds contempt. You get so familiar with certain truths that, so they're considered so true, of course. And before you've even said it, some people are already nodding their heads, yeah. Well, you know, I mean, how do they know if they really believe that or not? But they agree just because it's a natural way to be, you know, just agree. But that doesn't mean that the truth has really hit them or that the efficiency of that truth is still a vital thing for them. So it's essential that you understand when you think about this statement, what these truths are, that they're not just personal, but they are that, because you have to be aware of them personally. But they are universal truths. They're truths for everybody. They're things that you find across the board in all thought. And why do they lose their life and efficiency and lie bedridden in the dormitory of the soul, side by side with the most despised and exploded errors? And what happens to the mind then? It no longer can discern between that which is actually true and that which is error, because you've got them all down there in the somewhere in the bottom of your mind, and they're no longer, they have no efficiency for your life. They're not a part of your living. They're not a part of your thinking. Now, the reason that I read that to you is because this is what these writers of the Christian imagination are concerned about. They really are concerned about replenishing in people's minds and spirits the efficiency of truth, of these great, great universals, and particularly for the Christian truths. I almost hesitate. I hate to use the word Christian as an adjective, but I use it all the time, so there's no point in my belaboring the point. But it is true that there are many things that we just glibly call Christian, and really they shouldn't be delineated in that way. But there is a real sense in which universal truths are also Christian truths. They're truths that God has given to man. And these people who were in this group of inklings that we've been talking about were people who were really deeply concerned that the truths that were involved in Christianity, let's say, and in the universals that we understand as Christian in their meaning, that they be wakened up from the sleepiness of the dormitory of the soul and moved out of that companionship with error and put into place again as lively, energizing, efficient truth. And if there's one thing that you really ought to feel, I think, as you read through these people, is a tremendous energy of truth. This is not a kind of a you know, a kind of a swallowing whole of this or that doctrine or this or that idea. But what you are coming up against is an energizing power in truth. And this is where, when truth loses its efficiency, it no longer has any energy for you. It doesn't have any life-changing power for you. It doesn't have any motive-changing power for you or anything else. And it's because it's been shelved someplace to be, you know, looked at periodically, see if it's still there, maybe dusted off, put back. But it's of its being the kind of thing that peoples your imagination and makes your life different, you know, that isn't there anymore. And this is the real underlying motif of and motive of the of these writers. And the reason we take, at least the reason I feel that Dante is so important is that all of these people who are in the group of Inklings, Lewis and Tolkien and Williams and Dorothy Sayers, were all people who had a strong respect and a strong influence from Dante and from the Divine Comedy. And because of this, I just felt for a long time we didn't do this. We didn't study the Inferno particularly or any of the rest of the comedy with the Lifestylers because I just thought, well, it just seemed like a lot of extra things to go into. But the more I read Dante, the more I realized that when you read him, you realize that you get at one of the great image makers. I mean, he goes beyond Charles Williams and Lewis and Sayers and so on. He's one of the greats. And it's a terrible thing to only introduce you to people who've been influenced by someone and never introduce you to the influencer, the person who has really had the formative power and shaper and shaping of these writers. So that's why I thought we should spend some time on Dante and get acquainted with him. You don't have to feel that it's that Dante is necessarily your cup of tea all the time, but he certainly is somebody that you should be soaked into a little bit so that you know something about his way of dealing with life and his understanding of the way in which imaginative writing can be, I hesitate to use the word of use because really you don't think of writing of this kind necessarily as being useful, and yet perhaps we could use better the word where it can be a real meaning for people. When we study Dante this week, I hope that some of this will not be just what I've told you, but that you will find that it's true also for yourselves. One of the things that Dorothy Sayers says in her introduction papers on Dante, I can't remember if it's in the introduction of the Inferno or not, but she says that great poets mean what they say. That unless we realize that what a poet is saying is actually meant for us, we can't have an interaction with it. And therefore, you know, it just falls to pieces as far as it becomes an academic study. But she says it's important that we understand that what is being said is not some little aesthetics that people who want to do special work in special fields of literature are involved with. But whether it's Chaucer or Dante or Shakespeare or Eliot or whoever, I mean, they mean what they say, and I hope T.S. Eliot's spirit is aware of the fact that I put him in that class. I usually don't, but in respect to John, I will. I mean, I don't put him in the class with Shakespeare and Dante and Chaucer, but I did feel that we needed to have some modern in so you wouldn't feel like they were all, you know, light years away from you. One great thing about Charles Williams is that You know, he believes very firmly that with God there is no past, present, or future. You know, eternity is now. And I like to really feel like one nice thing about having all these people dead is that they are now alive. You know, they're really alive for us, much more alive than they would have been probably if we'd even lived in the same century and lived in another country. They are really alive for us because their work is so living, and they're part of the you know, great cloud of witnesses that we're surrounded with. And so when you talk about Dante, just remember, he's a live option. He's not, you know, he's not just a dead and gone, you know, bag of bones someplace in the church in Ravenna. I think that I should probably go a little farther in that statement of Dorothy Sayers, in which she says that a great poem is not the perquisite of scholars and critics and historians. It is yours and mine, our freehold and our possession. And what it truly means to us is a real part of its true and eternal meaning. In other words, when a poet is written, as these poets have and these writers have, then the interaction of our involvement with that writing and our reading of that writing is an actual kind of contribution, you might say, to the work itself. It isn't the same. It's not going to be the same inferno to Teresa or Matt or Chris or Carla. It's going to be your own particular ones. You see, I mean, you are reading this with what where your experience leads you. Some of it is going to be colored, of course, by the fact that there are notes and there's going to be some influenced by some of the things that I may say. But on the other hand, nobody can actually lead you through that inferno except Dante and Virgil themselves. And you have to be a part of all those experiences, and you have to be exposed to that kind of impression that each of those circles and those pouches and those rings of hell have. And what it works on you is essential to the meaning of the poem. The poem has no meaning as long as it is, you know, closed up like this and is just read about. Unless you've actually gotten smack into the middle of it and really know what's there, it's just, as I say, it's one of these name-dropping things that all of us really detest and yet all of us fall prey to. Just before I came in here, I thought, dear me, I don't think I've ever really looked up in a big dictionary the word allegory, and because allegory is so often used in connection with imagery and with poems like the comedy and like Pilgrim's Progress and like the Fairy Queen and so on, I thought, well, I better just look it up because I don't even know what the derivatives, why don't they came from? And one of the big old Webster's in the apartment in there, so I just quickly looked it up, and it said that allegory was a description of one thing under the image of another. The description of one thing under the image of another. And I think actually I really like the way Dorothy Sayers puts it. It's a really good little sort of a capsule-like description. But an allegory is a dramatized metaphor. Now you know what a metaphor is. Something that says something for something else. It's sort of like this little statement about what an allegory is. An allegory is a dramatized metaphor. In other words, you've got something going here, you know. You've got some action. You don't just have, it isn't just flat. The next thing is, and this is bringing it down to the most simple points of these forms of speech. A metaphor is a compressed simile. And what's a simile? A simile is a perception of likeness in unlike things. Now, it's not quite true that they are so unlike that you can't find some likeness. But if it's exactly alike, then why would you say it? You know, if it's an exactly, I mean, if two people look exactly alike, and they are exactly alike, it's kind of a redundance to just, you know, belabor that point. But if you're going to really use a figure of speech, then you have to think of a simile as being something that's like something, and yet there's something about it that will, you know, prod the imagination so that that person will catch something new. A simile is the perception of likeness in unlike things presented in such a way that the understanding of the one helps to understand the other. You see what I mean? That as you see that the simile, when it's given to you, helps you to understand not just the one side, but both of them are enlarged in your understanding. This is also true in the, especially true, in the way in which imagery is used in the comedy by Dante. And last time we just touched on this whole concept and the whole understanding of images and imagery, and I don't think I explained about natural symbols and conventional symbols, did I?
No.
Well, I think, although as I say, I hate to talk about something before you get into the text, but I promise you we won't spend the whole time on explanations. But at least this does not tell you how to interpret Dante. I mean, this is just plain, pure and simple understanding English style and ways of writing and poetry. A conventional symbol is one that is an arbitrary one. For example, if you take symbol for plus or minus, particularly plus in arithmetic. Now, is there anything that indicates why a plus sign, why would that mean plus? What does it have to do with it? It has two lines, but I mean, you and I know so deeply in our minds that that's what it means. It's hard to shake loose from the fact that it really doesn't mean that. That's an informed meaning. It's been conventionalized. It's arbitrary. We all accept it. It's like a lot of words. They have absolutely nothing to do with what is said, but we all accept it. It's a terminology that we've become accustomed to. Now, a natural symbol, on the other hand, can also be like a plus. It could be like this. Only in that understanding, it would be a cross meaning. It could mean a crossroads. You know, driving along the highway, you can't always expect that people are going to be able to understand or read. Sometimes you see a deer leaping across the road on the side of the sign. When you come to a curve, you see sometimes that kind of an arrow, and sometimes you see this, which means that you're coming to a crossroad. Well, does the crossroad? It does resemble that, doesn't it? I mean, it is something. Of course, it isn't that even, but it does give you the feeling that there is a crossroads there. All right. Now, granted that that is what we would call a natural symbol, because it's related to what is there, perfectly understandable. How can that symbol also be interpreted? Is there any other way that we would interpret a crossroads? Certainly, not driving a car, say, or not walking someplace, but you saw someone at a crossroads, and they didn't look like they knew what they were going to do. How would you explain that symbol as a literary image? What's happening to the person when he's standing there at the crossroads?
Making a decision.
Yeah, he's making a decision, of course. You see, a crossroads is a decision-making symbol. Well, I mean, we don't make that kind of a symbol and say, this is a decision-making symbol, but we transfer the cross, the symbol of this crisscross, or this thing, to the crossroads. The crossroads also mean, in still a natural symbol, you see, on the other side, it's a person can make a decision at the crossroads. It can be a decision-making symbol. Now, that doesn't mean that you use that little formal symbol of it. You don't say, you know, when you see a cross, you say, that means decision-making. No, you're moving from the symbol itself to an interpretation of what happens to you when you are at a crossroads. So that you move from that to the crossroads actual experience, and then you move where you're deciding whether you should go up the street or down another street, and which way should you take. Then there's also the possibility that that same crossroads symbol, no longer in this kind of a form, but the crossroads concept or image in your mind, is also the crossroads that you had to come to when you decided to come here, right? You had to make a decision in your minds as to whether or not you would do this or you would do that. When you would take a job or you would come to Holden. Whether you would go to school or come to Holden. Whether you would fight with your parents about coming to Holden or whether you would decide that
you weren't going to come.
You give up. Or maybe you are here because they forced you to come. I don't know. But I don't think so, because it seems to me that was one of the prerequisites is that you want to come yourselves. But I mean, the thing is that the crossroads has a decision-making element in it all the way along the line. Now, these are the ways symbols develop and eventually become images, you see? They stand for something other than just what they look like. And so when you say somebody is at the crossroads of life, that's an important time in life because... And don't ask me when that is, because But some people's lives, I guess, are not interspersed with as many crossroads as we have. But I will say this, that crossroads are interesting. It would be very dull if it all went straight down, paved right straight through. And so many people think that that's what it is to be a Christian, and I always think, well, I don't know. Either you must be awfully good, or else you don't know the same God I know, because I certainly believe that there isn't any other such way, any other way to live a Christian life except existentially, continually making decisions. It's a never-ending thing. Now then, when you take this kind of symbol, this kind of standing for something else, so that you can understand it, and you put it into what we called a dramatized metaphor or an allegory, you've got what we have in Pilgrim's Progress. How many of you know anything about Pilgrim's Progress? Maybe you needn't have read it, but do you know that it's the story of a man who is who is out on the road of life, and he's gradually going to, fight temptations all the way to finally reach through to the city of glory. And when this man is doing this, all the different temptations that he meets are all very obviously, they have names that Mr. Worldly Wise, for example. I mean, you couldn't possibly get him mixed up with anybody else, could you? There wasn't much discovery left for that. And when he crosses the Slough of Despond, it's called the Slough of Despond. Well, I mean, you don't have to discover any new truth there because it's already given to you. Well, all the characters in Federalist Progress, it still is a fascinating story. It's amazing, you know. I mean, wrote it in prison, and I think prison and exile must be a very good place to do things, because Dante wrote the comedy in exile, and Bunyan wrote the Pilgrim's Progress in prison. So, you know, try it. You may have to. But at least Pilgrim's Progress is really an exciting story. It's really well done and has become a great classic for all people. I had to read it as part of my graduate work at the University of Minnesota, and nobody could understand why I knew so much about it. Well, you know, it was obviously it was a journal of a Christian. I could identify with an awful lot of those things, and the rest of the people in that graduate class were trying to remember everything, you know, and what does this mean, and of course this is this, and this, now he's at this point. Well, I mean, it was sort of like just another form of a diary of anybody who's trying to live a Christian life. And, I mean, surely put in very obvious terminology, but just the same. It wasn't that hard for me to catch on. And I remember my professor was a very dried up, weasened old guy. Well, Miss Ansgarten, it's amazing you know so much about this. Nobody was expecting anybody to respond to it, but I did tell him in the orals when I had my graduate exams. We had to take orals even for master's degrees, and in those days, that's so long ago. But anyway, I understood all the 17th century because, you know, I'm a Christian, and I guess that's where the Christians were in the 17th century. Oh, they looked. But it's true, you know, it's really true that it was very easy to identify with the kinds of things that were happening in Pilgrim's Progress. The thing about the comedy is that those people in the Inferno are not people that you necessarily know or identify with right away, but when you take a little time, you realize that they have something to say to you. But they all of them have, Dante has this whole story going on as a real person, and the people that are in the Inferno, in all these different circles of hell, are real people. They're people that he knew, many of them, or people that he knew about. They're not characters that have just been made up to fit a virtue or a fault, you see. They are actual people who were human beings on the earth. And this is quite a different kind of writing and use of imagery. And that's why I think allegory, sometimes it's a good thing that we have a different understanding of allegory as being, when it's the way in which Bunyan did it, where it's very obviously these characters are fixed, actually made to fit the crime, you might say. It's like in Gilbert and Sullivan, punishment fits the crime. That's true in Inferno, certainly. But the characters fit the faults and are very obvious. But in Dante, the images are all discovered. You have to discover them because they're not carefully placed with a name on them. That you know at once this is lust, or this is sloth, or this is Mr. Worldly Wise, or Mr. Moneybags, or whatever name happens to be attached to it. These are not, they have real names. And the man that suffers from gluttony has a name of his own, and it's his, and Dante knew him. You see, there's much more pathos in a story that is people with real people. Now, I don't know any of these people in the Inferno, but I must say that when I read it, I feel really depressed by what's happening to them. Even if I don't, I mean, goodness, they lived in the 13th century. Well, I can't say that they have any, you know, they're certainly no blood relatives of mine, but somehow the humanity of the story is such that you can't help but feel a real gripping of the whole pathos of human beingness. And that's what the comedy is about. And even more than that, the comedy gives you all these people all along the way, all through Dante's walk with Virgil. People who have all been caught as their lives were being lived in the great refusal of God. The great refusal. You might put that, you could put those three words over the inferno. These people had refused. They just refused to live the life of God that God wanted them to have. And so all of them are caught in all the different ways in which that refusal comes. And you know, it's not, you may think at times that it looks kind of far out and really, really, really bloody, and yet you stop and think of it, and you think of how you identify with these things, and you realize how what Dante is doing is simply putting it out on wide screen, what's going on inside here. Not that good, you know. We may kid ourselves and the people around us, but you know, you read the Inferno by yourself and let it soak in and minister to you, and you find out that you can identify with quite a few of those. You aren't going to, you know, bite and devour other people literally with your teeth. But how often do we not do it in other ways?
Where does Great Divorce fit in with that, in terms of allegory and image?
Well, I think that's more like a dramatized metaphor. It's like an allegory in that it's not a whole, you know, it's not a whole long story of real people like the Inferno is. It's more people that are sort of setups in order to, and yet they interact with each other, and they very obviously are people that have real qualities and problems and faults, but they are not they have not had a long life that is interacted upon as you have in Dante, or as you have in the novels of Charles Williams, or the other novels of Lewis. I think The Great Divorce is more like an essay almost, but in a dramatized form. Mm. You know, it's a story, but still it's so obviously it's teaching something. Whereas you in these other writings, they don't have to teach. You can read the Inferno. Well, you don't have to be a Christian to read the Inferno at all. People can read it for the sheer poetry of it. And you can read Charles Williams just for the sheer entertainment of it. And you can read Lewis for science fiction just for the entertainment. And I know people who read the Narnia books to their children who never think that it has any other meaning except just that it's a neat story about animals.
Yeah.
You know, they never make the switch over. And for Lewis and Sears and all these people, this was of prime importance that you didn't have to feel that you caught the lesson in order to enjoy it. The primary thing was that they had to be entertaining, they had to be interesting, they had to be, really captivating in and of themselves. And then when you're really hooked, then the bait and the net begin to catch you, you see. And all of a sudden you're surrounded and you begin to, when you try to get out, you're just really covered. I often think that, you know, the Lord says, you know, about catching, you know, being fishers of men. And I said to somebody, well, you know, after all, you do have to have bait to catch fish. And this person said, oh, well, not in the time of Jesus, they used nets. Well, I said, okay, nets. No, I don't care. And really, this is what the net of these imaginative writings are really, they really catch you. So watch out. You know, you have to be on your guard a little bit that you don't get really caught by this, in case you just would rather not get involved with Christianity. It's good to be aware of it. It's like Lewis said, you know, watch it when you read certain books, because you know, they do have certain, you know, built-in baits to them and hooks that you may not be aware of. So I'm just a word to the wise here. When I said that the comedy was the story of the great refusal of all kinds and conditions of men, I said it with the idea of one particular thing in mind. The people in the Middle Ages were not all that stupid. Now, we think that we've just really made it with psychology and you know, we've, after all, they didn't have Freud and Jung, and they didn't have Adler, and they didn't have B.F. Skinner, and they didn't have Fromm, and they didn't have, what's the man that does the TA, who finds out about the child and the adult in there, whatever he is. Anyway, they didn't have Masters and Johnson, and they didn't have all those other people that know about sex. They didn't know any of those people. And yet, no, you know what they knew? They knew very well that every creature had what they called a prime will, what we would call an instinct, that that animals, vegetables, and plants, and so on, fish, all had a prime will, a deep instinct of survival that just, you know, kept them going. Well, beyond that prime will, man has something else. Beyond the prime will, man has the ability to sort and select what he's going to do with that prime will. In other words, he doesn't just follow his instincts. And they called it the threshold. This is what Dante calls it, the threshold of ascent. At the at the entrance of the soul, or the unconscious, whichever name you want to put on it, and I don't think the soul is unconscious, but for the medievalist, this would probably relate as well as any, because they didn't really study in any way the meaning of the subconscious or the unconscious as such. But what they believed very firmly was that there were many, many, many things that came up to the threshold of ascent in a person's life of decision making. And as these possibilities of decision come to you, you are able to use what they call the guardians of the threshold. That is, you're able to either close the door to the ones that were going to drag you down, and open the door to the ones that were going to move you on toward the heavenly city. Or you could do as some of the people in the Inferno did, and remain in the threshold itself and in the vestibule. Remember, at the very beginning of the Inferno, here are all these people that never were able to make up their minds. Now, this great concept of this threshold of ascent is what the all these different ways in which people answered this knocking at the door of these instincts or demands that were being made on these persons, the way in which they answered this call, you might say, is what the Inferno is made up of. That's why you have these people who are involved in lust, in avarice, in gluttony, in political treachery, in hating of people to such an extent that they really were, you know, violent murderers. Every kind of thing that developed out of this kind of lack of being aware of what kind of decision that they had to make. And the whole of the Divine Comedy is a kind of a composite imagery of all of these kinds of experiences, all the way through the Inferno and through the Purgatory and even up into the Paradise. So you have a remarkable, just you know, just a peopled kind of a tapestry of people who have turned off God, people who have not quite turned him off in purgatory, and people who have really turned him on in paradise. You know, it's really a very, very exciting kind of thing to think about, because the interesting thing is, this is where the first line of the imagery runs. All these people and what happened to them. Then the second line of the imagery is the fact that you and I are involved in this because it's also the story of the soul, of any soul. And you and I are part of that. And the kind of temptations that meet every single person in this life. And it's to give us the awareness that, you know, we better be on guard and watch it, or we're going to fall into these traps that we're reading about. We don't necessarily have already had to fallen into them. No, indeed, the point of the story is that the story is independent. It just goes along, and we are to discover for ourselves the meanings that are involved in all those images and how they relate to us. And then along with all that kind of relationship with imagery, you have the imagery of Dante himself, who is going through this whole story as an example of one person who is going the way of someone who has at one time been awakened to the tremendousness of the heavenly vision, and who has fallen away and gets lost in this dark wood, and then how he finally comes back all the way up. And that's another picture, another image of what can happen to us. Doesn't mean it has, but it can. You see, none of these are predictable. That's why I say you have to put yourself into the reading of the comedy, because you're not the same as I am, or the same age, or the same temperament, or anything else. And your temptations are quite different. And so some of them you'll relate to, and some of them you won't, just as I do. But you're never going to know what they're like unless you try it, unless you try the reading of it and see what's being described and how they hit you. So you read the comedy not just as an academic thing, not just as a little study and something you had to do for lifestyle because he's a great classical figure in literature, but you read it because it's a personal poem. It's something that you really can identify with. Well, let's just take a look at some of the beginning, at least, of the Well, I read a little bit to you last time. The good thing about the Sears translation is that she has some very well-documented pictures. You know, she has diagrams of hell and diagrams of purgatory. And if you look on page 70, you have a very good picture of what hell looks like. See, it's a funnel, and it's drawing down. You know, it's like Carla's whistling last night on the really biggest stories. I thought right away, well, she ought to double for the funnel in hell, because you've had this feeling of an almost horrible fascination of the evil pulling you down, terrible as it is. And you realize that as he goes around the circles of hell, he's simply being introduced to all these different characters and people who are not going to really, they haven't gone down to that bottom pit yet. I don't know how many of you, did I ask you how many of you had to read Milton in high school? Did you read Paradise Lost? Anybody? Anybody have any bit of it in your history of English literature? You didn't read any of Milton? on my mind. It's getting to be a very impoverished generation. I think it's not just your generation, you know. It's been going on for quite a while, because after all, it's very hard to get all this in when you have to take film and communication and all kinds of different kinds of body arts and things that really are important. And then you don't, you see, these other things just never get taken care of. Well, Milton has his picture of hell and of Satan have always caused problems, because people had the feeling that Milton really kind of hankered after Satan. He Jesus came off as kind of a goody-goody, and Satan was really interesting, really an exciting person. And he had the feeling somehow that he was still the great fallen angel. He was Lucifer, and he was the light bearer, even if it was a negative thing and a horrible thing. But still, he had the strength, and he came with all the hosts of his angels out of hell. They had a big meeting. They have a great council, and Satan talks about how they're going to get into the Garden of Eden. And so you really think, wow, that's really something. And they talk about intellectual fury. There, you have it. You know, the inferno, believe me, Dante doesn't give you any encouragement. Hell is not going to be interesting. It's not going to be intellectual. It's not going to have any fascination except the physical kind of thing that sometimes pulls you into something when you don't want to be pulled into, like the boiling tar that he felt like he was just being pushed down into it, even when he didn't want to. And the whole concept of Dante's inferno is horrible, really horrible. And you might think, that's so medieval. No, how can people pollute Christianity with that kind of thing? You can see what kind of nastiness people develop. And so I thought I'd read just a little bit from the scriptures. You get a little feeling of proper background. And if thy hand offend thee, this is from St. Mark, the 9th chapter, the 43rd verse. And if thy hand offend thee, cut it off. It is better for thee to enter into life maimed than having two hands to go into hell, into the fire that never shall be quenched, where the worm dieth not and the fire is not quenched. And if thy foot offend thee, cut it off. It is better for thee to enter halt into life than having two feet to be cast into hell, into the fire that never shall be quenched, where the worm dieth not and the fire is not quenched. And if thine eye offend thee, pluck it out. It is better for thee to enter into the kingdom of God with one eye than having two eyes to be cast into hellfire, where their worm dieth not and the fire is not quenched. He picked this up, you know, a very bad source, but the only one they had, you know, the Bible. Full of terrible things like that, you know, bad images. Well, you know, that's the problem with the 20th century. We're so smooth and sophisticated, and we don't do anything but produce atomic bombs and neutral bombs and things that just destroy property but don't, you know, just destroy people but don't hurt property. Yeah. My, you know, we really have advanced. Well, the thing is that that the horror of the statement that is in St. Mark is simply to make it clear that there is, you know, that these decisions are radical ones. They're not just, well, I feel like making a decision, I will or I won't. And so what the medievalist was concerned about was that there should be a real sense that it was important that you guard these thresholds of ascent where you decide how you're going to live and how you're going to move and with whom you're going to spend time, and so on. How many of you noticed what time of the year it was that this takes place? Mm-hmm. Yes, it's the end of Holy Week. Really, really amazing. It starts Holy Thursday night. And you notice that Dante is in this dark wood. And you'll find many, many times in reading that this little phrase, the dark wood, will come up. Not in other writings that you read, and many of the images that come out of Dante are things that are used, just taken for granted by people who write. But because most of us are illiterate in that particular direction, we don't know to what they're referring. But now you will know. Boy, would that be nice. Well, I don't really think that's the important reason for your learning to read this. It is a side benefit and one of the fringe things. The reason that Dante teaches this, for instance, he says here, midway this way of life we're bound upon, I woke to find myself in a dark wood, for the right road, was wholly lost and gone. Now, one of the horrible things about life is that we sometimes don't know when we've really made the final and fatal last crossroad and taken the wrong turn. We don't know when that happens. Because, as he says, I woke up. It's just as if I'd been asleep all this time, and I'd lost my way. And this is quite true of the human being as he goes through life. He quite often doesn't know when it happens that he loses his way. Because, and you know, you often think that all decisions are very obviously right or wrong. We can be a Christian. We know. We all know. But we don't know. And many times, the decisions we make lead us farther and farther afield from the center. And this is another thing that Dante's involved in, is the fact that you can go to sleep and get lost in a dark wood and never find your way out. And I read a marvelous book this summer by Carson McCullers. Now, everybody knows Carson McCullers because of The Heart of the Lonely Hunter. I can't remember it now, because everybody knows it, of course. I'm glad you told me. I couldn't remember the name of it. But she wrote a book called Clock Without Hands. And it's about a man who, a pharmacist down in a southern town, who suddenly finds out that he has leukemia, and he's going to die very soon. And he gets a hold of a book of Kierkegaard, and he's never read any books much. And he reads this one little section on fear and trembling. And he keeps wondering, what does this mean? And he goes to his minister and asks, how can I get ready to die? I'm going to die in 6 months. What should I do in the minister? All right, we all have to do that sometime. You know, and then he passes and says, absolutely nothing. Just nothing. And the man realizes, he says, where did I lose my way? Where did I lose my way? I don't know, when I got into this sort of aimlessness of living, where I just really am living just entirely as Dante describes the plants and the vegetables and the animals, just following the prime will of just feeding and sheltering and procreating, and that was it. You see, I mean, just that's all there was to life. And he realizes, but now I'm going to die and something else is going to happen to me. How do I find out? Where am I supposed to go for help? And the whole sort of crux of the book is in this man is still in the dark wood even when he dies, because nobody could help him. Nobody could help him. It really grips you. I suppose that little book wasn't so popular as the other one, because it doesn't have the kind of drama in it, and it's much more of a, it's probably not as well written either. But for my taste, it was a real experience. So it isn't just something that happens to people in the Middle Ages and is written about them, but it also happens to people in the 20th century.
And this is what makes the comedy a contemporary thing. And then he says, how I got into it, the word, I cannot say because I was so heavy and full of feet. When first I stumbled from the narrow way. See, I mean, before at last I stood beneath a steep hillside which clothed that valley's wandering maze, whose dread had pierced into the heart, root deep. When I looked up and saw the morning rays mantle its shoulder from that planet bright which guides men's feet aright on all their ways. And this a little quieted the affright that lurking in my bosom's length had lain through the long horror of that piteous night. And this is what, you know, really fun. Till always says trouble with the Bible commentators is that they spend all their time in studies, and they never did any wrestling, they never did any running, they never did any skiing, they never did any swimming. They don't know the images of the physical life. And because one of the favorite passages is where the referee is talked about, and the translation is always arbitrator or judge or something like that. And the Greek word is referee. It's a person who's at a game. And everybody knows what a referee is, except the professors who are getting their doctorates and their extra books written and so on and so on. And you get a feeling, and he just saw this thing swimming, and you see, and you turn around and look behind him. You know? And the perilousness of it has gotten to him. And the panting. How many of you think? I mean, you know, you do pant. I could say how many of you have asthma, and you also know how to pant. But the swimming is such a great kind of a common image for everybody to catch. He talks about resting again. See, not far from where the mountainside first rose, a leopard, nimble and light and fleet, clothed in a fine furred pelt, all dapple-dyed, came gambolling out and sits before my feet, hindering so that from the forthright line, time and again, I turn to beat retreat. You know, it was a beautiful, beautiful animal. Beautiful, gambling, you know, graceful, lovely. But what did he do? You know, every time Donnie wanted to make a step forward, he was just, you know, oh, no, you don't. Try it again, and no, you don't. He went back some more. No, he was getting nowhere. And I think the attractiveness of the leopard is really important. You know, there's lots of times the things that stop you up. Very attractive. The morn was young, and in his native sign the sun climbed with the stars, whose glitterings attended on him when the love divine first moved those happy prime created things. So the sweet reason in the newborn day filled me with hope and cheerful augurings of the bright beast so speckled and so gay. But not so much but that I fell to quaking at a fresh sight, a lion in the way. Saw him coming swift and savage, making for me, head high with ravenous hunger, raving, so that for dread the very air seemed shaking, and next a wolf grunt, with the famished craving lodged ever in a horrible lean flank. The ancient cause of many men's enslaving, she was the worst. At that dread sight, a blank despair and whelming terror pinned me fast until all hope to scale the mountain sank. Like one who loves the games he has amassed, and meets the hour when he must lose his loot, distracted in his mind and all aghast, even so was I, faced with that restless brute, which little by little edged and thrust me back to that place wherein the sun is meet. See, back to the woods, he's going to be pushed back into the same place. He's finally, you know, like the same swimmer, he's finally moved out, and now he's being pushed back into it again, and he's like, I'm never going to make it. And then all of a sudden, he sees good old Virgil. Mm-hmm. You know, I suppose you don't know Virgil very well either if you haven't had much to do with Milton, but Virgil was a Latin poet who wrote the story of the Aeneid. and that's the story of Troy, and he wrote it in Latin, whereas Homer wrote the epic in Greek. And he also, of course, wrote a great deal of poems about the Roman state and about the importance of the Roman Empire. And Virgil was a great saint, patron saint of the Italians, because he was Latin. He wasn't Greek. Homer would have been, you see, from another culture and another country. And although he's a greater writer in the terms of the whole gamut of writers that we know, still, Virgil was the person that would naturally be the one to help out Dante, because they both were part of the same land. And Virgil tells him what he was, you know, what he's up to. And he has been sent by Beatrice from heaven to come down and help Dante out of all this mess he's gotten into. Well, he was able to get to keep them out of the way of the wolf and the leopard and the lion, so that they were able to move into the next, he was able to move into the next part of his traveling out of the dangerous wood, and then he finds out that he's going to have to do something very, very difficult. And Virgil says he'll stay with him, he'll stay right close to him and guide him, but he'll have to do as he says, and they'll eventually get through hell and through purgatory and up to the paradise. On page 79, one nice thing too about the Sayers translation, she does have a little rundown on what's happening. But the only difficulty is because you can read that, you can also skip. You know, you can tell what's going on. You really can do pretty well by reading these little prose accounts at the beginning of each canto and move right straight through the whole thing and find out, well, to all intents and purposes, what the Inferno is about. But you won't really know what the Inferno is about because you will not have felt anything. And unless you feel something from this, it's really, you know, it isn't going to have done you much good. So don't just read the little rundown. So there are some cantos you may not have time to read all of them, but do read long enough into it so that you allow it to captivate you. You really can't just drop in and out. You have to read it, say, for an hour to get a whole kind of a feeling that you have been transposed from this snowy spot to a very hot spot in the center of the earth. You know, I mean, it takes a little doing. It isn't like reading contemporary things, nor is it even like reading something that takes place on earth. It takes a big physical leap of the imagination almost to get into it and to allow it to happen to you so that it has somewhat of a realistic structure for you. He's just exactly like all of us, because this canto is full of excuses. And he explains why he doesn't think he should go. He really doesn't feel that he's up to this. And he says, down there in the tenth line, I soon began, poet, dear guide, for why surely to test my powers and weigh their worth, ere trusting me to this great enterprise? Thou sayest the author of young Silvius birth did to the world immortal, mortal goal clothed in the body of flesh he wore on earth. Granted. If hell's great foeman deign to show to him such favor, now hell's great foeman is of course the Lord, you know, he's the only one that really, you know, attacked hell. Seeing the vast effect in what and who has destined issue, no, that need surprise no thoughtful intellect. Since to Rome's fostering city and empery high heaven had sealed him as a father elect. Both these were there established, verily, to found that place, holy and delicate, Rome, wherein great Peter's heir should hold his see, whose the deed thy verses celebrate taught him the road to victory and bestowed the papal mantle in its highest state. He's giving it a lot of good theological, you know, drapery, so Virgil is going to see that, you know, I'll just, you know, I know about all this, and these other people that went to hell, they had, you know, they had reason to go, and they've done that, so why should I? And he says, thither the chosen vessel in like mode went afterward, and much confirmed thereby the faith that sets us on salvation's road. But how should I go there? Who says so? Why? I'm not Aeneas. Aeneas, you know, took this long, long trip, you know, wandered all over after the burning of Troy. And I am not Paul. Who thinks me fit? Not others, and not I. Say I submit and go. Suppose I fall into some folly. Though I speak but ill, thy better wisdom will construe it all. As one who wills, and then unwills his will, changing his mind with, I like that little statement. Somebody wills to do something, then you unwill your will. That's quite a deal, you know, but I've done it. I'm sure you have. As one who wills and then unwills his will, changing his mind with every changing whim, till all his best intentions come to nil. So I stood havering in that moorland dim, while through fond wrists of fancy oozed away the first quick zest that filled me to the brim. It oozed away all those good intentions. But you really feel, oh, I really am going to, I'm going to live it up today with all that God has given me. I'm really going to be with it. And then, you know, pretty soon, you know, something happens and it's going to zips and oozes. And, you know, and you sit down to your third cup of coffee and you look at a magazine and then Well, you see, this is the mood. I'm really exaggerating it. No, I'm not, because that's the way we do. But what I want you to feel is that this describes us. But you know, as long as you feel like it's just a little literary thing, and I'm supposed to notice this figure of speech, it's not going to hit you. Well, I'll try to make it hit you. If I have grasped what thou dost seem to say, the shade of greatness answered, Virgil, these doubts breed from sheer black cowardice, which day by day lays ambushes for men, checking the speed of honorable purpose in mid-flight, as shapes half seen startle a shying steed. Well, any of you who's seen horses and or ridden them knows, you know, that if a horse will just really go absolutely crazy if it gets a feeling that there's something coming, and if you're in front of me, he says, that's exactly the way you are. Well then, to rid thee of this foolish fright, hear why I came, and learn whose eloquence urged me to take compassion on my plight. And he describes Beatrice, whom Dante had fallen in love with when she was a young girl, and we're going to discuss later some of that kind of thing. He never had any, quote, affair with her. He married somebody else. He had no relationships with her, except I think he saw her and talked with her about three or four times. But it was an experience for him of falling in love in a real sense. He was just hit with the experience of this. And Dante uses this as an image of the way in which we fall into eternal life. That is the way when God grabs us. It's a similar kind of a switch from, so that all of our direct line of the way we've always done things is suddenly colored and changed by an experience. Now, it may not be love, or it may be a great cause that grabs you or something like that, but for Dante, it was a girl that he saw and fell in love with, and this kind of has been the image. Well, we'll we'll discuss this later, but I don't want to spend any time on it right now because I want you to get a little bit more of the words of the poetry. As this goes on, you find a lot of very, very good lines all the way through, and down there on page 81, it's Virgil's speech to at the end, after he tells all about the conversation he had with this heavenly visitation of Beatrice. Virgil says, he explains all this to Dante and says, now look, here are all these angels and wonderful people from heaven that are really concerned about you. Now he says, what ails thee then? Why this dull delay? Why bring so white a liver to the deed? Why canst thou find no manhood to display when through such blessed ladies deign to plead thy cause at that supreme assize of right? And when my words promise thee such good speed? As little flowers, which all the frosty night hung pinched and drooping, lift their stalks and fan their blossoms out, touched by the warm white light, so did my fainting powers, and therewith ran such good strong courage round about my heart, that I spoke boldly out like a free man, oh blessed she that stooped to take my part, oh courteous thou to obey her true discerning speech, and thus promptly to my rescue start. Fired by thy words, my spirit now is burning so to go on and see this venture through, I find my former stout resolve returning. Forward, henceforth, there's but one will for two, thou master and thou leader and thou lord. I spoke, he moved, so, setting out anew, I entered on that savage path and forward. You know, he really catches you, you know. You get a feeling that this is a guy that's really, he's really going through something. Now, it takes a great deal of intellectual imagination to move into this world of Dante. It takes a great deal of intellectual imagination to discover these images and to see the meaning that is continually being woven back and forth for you in a very obvious kind of a story. Now, you really have to apply yourself to the reading of this piece of literature. You can't, as I say, it just doesn't come at you like masterpiece theater or a documentary or anything, good as those things are. This is something that you actually have to dig into. And you have to read it somewhat the way I did. You've got to, you don't have to read it out loud, but you have to read it as if there were an actual pulse beat in it. Because that's the way Dante wrote it. So I just want to really give you that encouragement, because I feel like it's going to bore you otherwise. I mean, you can be bored by great literature, heaven knows. I have been, and I'm sure you have. But it's not boring if you are not bored. But it's because we are boring that the literature is boring, you know? It's because we're so dull. And we've just never exercised anything, and it's all been exercised upon us. So, when you look at, on page 84, you see the upper hell. And you see Canto 3, beginning. And this is the vestibule of hell, where the futile, as Dorothy Sayers writes up there in that little, and she does write so well that even her introductions are good on the canto. Mm-hmm. Where the futile run perpetually after a whirling standard. And you know, this is the entrance where it says, abandon hope all ye who enter here. Through me the road to the city of desolation, through me the road to sorrows dire eternal. Through me the road among the lost creation. Justice moved my great maker, God eternal rotten, the power and the unsearchably high wisdom and the primal love supernal. Nothing ere I was made to be save things return, and I return abide. Lay down all hope, you that go in by me. These words of somber color I described writ on the lintel of a gateway. Sir, this sentence is right hard for me, I cried, and like a man of quick discernment. Here lay down all thy distress, did he, reject dead from within me every coward fear. We've reached the place I told thee to expect, where thou shouldst see the miserable race, those who have lost the good of intellect. And those who have lost the good of intellect, that's a phrase that really identifies all these people in the inferno. The people who have lost the good of intellect, which meant that they could still make decisions, where the intellect could still, where they were living in the image instead of what the image meant. And you find that Paolo and Francesca, who are the two lovers that Dante sees and feels so badly about because they're whirling in an embrace, and he can't understand why what's happened? And why should they be this way? After all, she was married to a very ugly man, and his handsome young brother, a relative, came to visit, and they just read a romance together, and, why shouldn't it happen? Why shouldn't it? Well, in Dante's world, and in Dante's understanding of hell, it didn't make any difference. If it happened, you are left with the happening for eternity. And this is what you finally get from all these experiences, is that you are left with what you did as a permanent fixture. That's all it ever got to be. They just, how would you like to be wrapped around some woman that you fell in love with for a little while and just whirl and whirl and whirl for eternity with sighs around you and nothing but misery and wailing? But that's what happens when just the moment is all that's really important. And Dante is so clear on this. But he doesn't preach it the way I am. The reason I'm preaching it to you is that you have to get used to catching these things for yourself. And I hope I'm not saying that I don't consider that you have good judgment, but I don't think you've had much judgment in this kind of writing. And therefore, I feel like I've got to really, exclamation point it a little bit, so that you get some feeling of it being an existential experience for you, something that you really can grab. And but this first section, part of this canto, 3, doesn't have anything to do with Paolo and Francesca. That comes later. But this one is just the vestibule where the people are who couldn't make up their minds. And they're all standing there, wondering what to do, and they've lost, as Dante says, the good of intellect. He laid his hand on mine, Virgil, and with a face so joyous that it comforted my quailing, into the hidden things he led my ways, here sighing, and here crying, and loud railing, smote on the starless air with lamentation, so that at first I wept to hear such wailing, tongues mixed and mingled, horrible execration, shrill shrieks, hoarse groans, fierce yells, and hideous blether and clapping of hands thereto, without cessation, made tumult through the timeless night that hither and thither drives in dizzying circles sped, as whirlwind whips the spinning sands together. And you just have a feeling of noise, and almost like a dentist drill, and louder and louder, and then shrieks, and then this kind of feeling that it's never going to stop. Whereat with horror flapping round my head, Master, what's this I hear? Who can they be, these people so distraught with grief? I said, and he replied, the dismal company of wretched spirits thus find their guerdon due, whose lives knew neither praise nor infamy. They're mingled with that kicked angel crew who against God rebelled not, nor to him were faithful, but to self alone were true. To thine own self be true, and thou canst not Remember him? Laertes in Hamlet? You know, his speech to Hamlet? To thine own self be true. Believe me, if that's the only thing you've got to be true to, you know, not too much. Heaven cast them forth, their presence there would dim the light. Deep hell rejects so base a herd, lest sin should boast itself because of them. Even hell doesn't want them. They were such a bunch of milksops that they couldn't even decide to be bad. Yeah, it is. You can see where Lewis got his images, a lot of them. You know, and thank goodness, you know, everybody doesn't have to dig into Dante in order to get some of the value of him, because both Lewis and Williams have translated it pretty well. But master, by what torment spurred are they driven on to vent such bitter breath? He answered, I will tell thee in a word, this dreary huddle has no hope of death, yet its blind life trails on so low and crass that every other fate is envious. No reputation in the world it has, mercy and doom hold it alike in scorn. Let us not speak of these, but look and pass. So I beheld a low and ensign born wheeling that span and ran as in disdain of any rest. And there the folk forlorn rushed after it in such an endless train. It never would have entered in my head there were so many men whom death had slain. And when I noted here and there a shade whose face I knew, I saw and recognized the coward spirit of the man who made the great refusal. The great refusal. See? And that proof sufficed. Here was that rabble, here without a doubt, whom God and whom his enemies despised. This scum, who never lived, now fled about naked and goaded, for a swarm of fierce hornets and wasps stung all the wretched rout until their cheeks ran blood, whose slubbered smears mingled with brine around their footsteps fell, where lonely wind licked up their blood and tears. Then I peered on ahead and soon quite well made out the hither bank of a wide stream where stood much people. Sir, said I, pray tell me these are. What's their custom? Why they seem so eager to pass over and be gone? I may trust my sight in this pale gleam of you to me. The whole shall be made known. Only have patience till we stay our feet on yonder sorrowful shore of Acheron. Abashed, I dropped my eyes, and lest unmeet chatter should vex and held my tongue, and so paced on with him in silence and discreet to the riverside, when from that far bank, lo, a boat shot forth, whose white-haired boatman old bawled as he came, woe to the wicked, woe! Never you hope to look on heaven. Behold, I come to ferry you hence across the tide, the endless night, fierce fires, and shramming cold. And thou, the living man there, stand aside from these who are dead. I budged not, but abode. So when he saw me hold my ground, he cried, away with thee, for by another road and other ferries thou shalt make to shore, not here. A lighter skiff must bear thy load. Then said my guide, Charon, why wilt thou roar and chase in vain? Thus it is willed, where power and will are one. It's a very good description of heaven, where power and will are one. Enough. Ask thou no more. This shut the shaggy mouth of that sour, infernal ferryman of the livid wash. Only his flame-winged eyeballs rolled a glower. And there's another, in another translation that I've been reading, I really feel like you have to hear that one, because I really like that particular way of describing Charon it almost better than the way she does it. Quiet thenceforth the fleecy jawbones grew of him. Fleecy jawbones is a wonderful way to describe a bearded person. You know, fleecy jawbones. There's many beards around here, but you know, I thought that was a marvelous way to describe it. But anyway, he Charon has to take him anyway because they are, he's ordered by God himself. But those outwearied, naked souls, how gash and pale they grew, chattering their teeth for dread when first they felt his harsh tongue's cruel lash. God they blasphemed their parents then, the human race, the place, the time, the blood, the seed that got them and the womb that bred. Then huddling, hugger-mugger, down they scud, dismally wailing, to the accursed strand, which waits for every man that fears not God. And one of the things you notice in just about all the way through the Inferno is the way that every one of us makes excuses. It's somebody else's fault. It's the parents. It's my parents' fault. And finally, of course, when you get back far enough, it's really God. It's like Adam, you know. It wasn't just you, but the woman whom thou gavest me, God. It's your fault, you know. So we have a goodly heritage of blaming. And this is what you get in all the way through in the comedy, is just one after another. And then this very, very good image of, this is not an image that you have to think about, it's just a beautiful one, in the middle of this misery. And as by one and one, leaves drift away in autumn, till the bough from which they fall sees the earth strewn with all its brave array. So from the bank there, one by one, drop all Adam's ill seed, and signaled off the mark as drops the falcon to the falconer's call. Away they're borne across the waters dark, and ere they land that side the stream, and on fresh troops this side come flocking to embark. There's a whole nother, Charon never lacks for people to come in his boat, because there's always more dead that are waiting at the bank to be ferried across. And they don't, you know, it isn't that they are so anxious to get to hell, but they really haven't any other place to go. You know, it's just, they're just pushed to this river, and then in they go. And the interesting thing is that when Dante gets into the boat, he has to fall in a swoon and go to sleep, because it's not possible for him to be ferried across that river and be awake and alive. See, he's the only live person. Now, we call it the river Lethe, or Lethe, the river of forgetfulness. And for Dante, there was no way for him to pass into hell without this deep swoon that would wipe away the experience of the passage. He's not really dead, but all our sleeps are a little death, you know. And this is what Dante experiences in this. Well, I think we should stop here.